Over the last 5 or so years, many trend following strategies, and there is high dispersion, so look at, you know, different managers, different investment processes, but many of these strategies have kept up with traditional stock bond portfolios, if not outperformed them. And here's like a fascinating stat that I pulled this up like 10 times because I was like, I must be doing the math wrong. But over the last trailing 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and 25 years, so trailing period across all of those, if you look at managed futures at just the index level, I'm not talking about some of the higher octane, really attractive alpha strategies, just
like the benchmark.
Yeah, the benchmark.
SocGen.
Yep. Yeah. SocGen CTA index. If you look at that versus the ag, like the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index, which used to be the Bloomberg Barclays, which used to be the Barclays Lehman, which used to be the Lehman Ag Index, but trend following has outperformed bonds in all of those periods.
The 60-40 portfolio had one job, and since 2022 and lately, it's been showing some signs of failure and difficulty in terms of maintaining that you know, stocks for growth, bonds for ballast. When stocks and bonds move in the same direction, when geopolitical shocks hit everything at once, and when correlations converge at exactly the wrong moment, diversification stops being a strategy and starts being an illusion, a label. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Director at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. My very special guest today is Paisley Nardini. Paisley has spent her career at the intersection of multi-asset portfolio construction and real-world risk management, from PIMCO to Invesco to her current role as Managing Director and Head of Multi-Asset Solutions at Simplify Asset Management. She holds both CFA and CAIA designations. She's one of the sharpest thinkers in the business when it comes to the question most advisors aren't asking loudly enough. If your portfolio isn't built for this environment, what's it actually built for? Today, we're going to get into rising asset correlations, the case for managed futures, the commodity supercycle, and why liquid alts deserve a much bigger seat at the advisor table.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Paisley, welcome. It is great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, happy to be back. I'm pleased that you guys invited me to rejoin you. I think we were just chatting. It's been almost a year and a lot has transpired, but in some respect, everything is the same as it was a year ago, which is the importance of having diversification in the portfolio. So I'm very happy to be back to speak on this topic today.
The timing couldn't be better given what 2026 has been so far. It almost felt like it had been way more than a year since we had talked. I actually initially, before even like realizing it, I thought it had been actually a 2 or 3 years since we talked.
I think we've aged 2 or 3 years in the last year, so that's probably
yeah,
why.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because also when you stop and think about it, you know, last week was the anniversary of what happened last April, and it was almost exactly the same scenario with the, you know, whipsaw that occurred in the extension, the truce, in the Strait of Hormuz.
There were a lot conflict. Of similarities from beginning of 25 to beginning of 26 that you just highlighted. I mean, even markets started to kind of roll over in mid to late February. The turmoil was kind of felt in March, and then we had this V-shaped recovery, and it's like almost like deja vu.
you can't help thinking sometimes that you know, that was just timed that way. Was that the exact purpose of the timing of things? But anyways, that's speculation. And today, of course, is interesting as well, because now, you know, in this Iran conflict that we've had for, 7 weeks now, now the Strait of Hormuz has opened up. So that's created some whipsaw action in the market, maybe certain amount of short covering, risk on activity. So it makes for, no shortage of interesting times for allocators, for advisors, for investors. Paisley, thank you again for joining us. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, so, one thing too, Pierre, I think as you mentioned this, and something I think quite a bit about, even though I'm out here talking about alternatives and diversification to traditional assets like stocks and bonds, is that markets continue to show their resiliency. And so even when we are talking about these additional sources of ballast or diversification for the portfolio, it's not to say that stocks and bonds won't continue to prevail, right? And I think betting against the equity market or stock market long term is a bit of a fool's errand. And so I just like, let's set the stage with the fact that diversifiers are a complement. They're an addition to the portfolio to improve the resiliency. They're not a replacement. This is not a doom and gloom. There's plenty of positive catalysts in the market. Right. And I think that's why, exactly to your point, these sharp rebounds, like markets are just spring loaded when we have this turmoil and geopolitical risks, supply demand shocks, and they're just waiting for things to resolve so they can kind of continue on their upward trajectory. And that's exactly what we continue to see. So the question becomes, we know we're going to continue to see these risks interjected within markets. How can you proactively and prudently think about participating in markets instead of just like all on one side of the equation or all on the other?
Yeah. And do you want to, you got to ask yourself, do you want to be, do you want this kind of action to become your daily hobby and to consume all of your time? Or do you want to set up your portfolio in such a way that it takes that into account? It takes the uncertainty and those kinds of moves into account so that you're not scrambling every single day like we have in some cases this past entire year, wondering, now this is happening, now that's happening, now this policy thing is happening, tariffs are back on the table, this crazy war. When you look at what it's I can't help thinking, I'm sure, I think the big questions, I know going into last week, the big questions were really, what are earnings going to look like, which kicked off this week. So looking forward from last week to this week, earnings were the big concern. The big banks were reporting this week. There's been some really great reporting of earnings. So a lot of confidence, to speak to that resiliency that you mentioned. And the other sort of big overarching question was, what happens in the Strait of Hormuz? Is that going to resolve? Is that going to look like it's going to start to resolve? Are we going to get on the track towards resolving that? Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the big questions now. But you can't build portfolios around these week-to-week, day-to-day, or month-to-month even questions. You have to build you got to build a portfolio with the long-term in mind and with some very not necessarily high conviction outlooks, but I think if investors continue to be anchored to the idea that stocks have positive drift over the long term, that's really the anchor of growth in any portfolio is the equity position. The real question, I think, for the last number of years with vis-a-vis, what's going on in rates market, the Fed and the size of national debt, both in the U.S. and in North America and in Canada, of course, mm-hmm. is what happens to the bond market? What's going on in the bond market? And we've seen the bond market oscillate between the 10 years between somewhere in the high threes to where it is today. At
talk about range
so.
Bound. We're in like our third year now of the 10-year yield sitting, like you said, between 4 and upwards of 4.5. And it just seems, it's like pinball. It just seems to keep finding these guardrails where it bounces up and down and back and forth. And I think that's actually provided some pretty attractive opportunities for investors that feel like, oh, I've missed the duration trade, or it's now not time to have duration in the portfolio, that you've been it's been pretty easy to trade that over the last couple of years. Yeah. And when I say easy, there has been a lot of volatility in the rates market, so I'm not diminishing Absolutely. That. But I do think, trends can persist, but they don't stay constant for very long. And so I think as we reflect over the last few years, noticing this range-bound movement rates, there are several catalysts that could push the 10-year yield below that 4% or above 4.5%. And I think the narrative that has been front and center over the last 12 months is that the rates will move out of this range and they will move higher. And I know that's not felt by everyone, but I think that narrative has pushed many investors away from bonds. And I say this, even though we're talking about ways to diversify away from bonds today, I think that maybe so many people are looking the opposite direction, thinking we have higher inflation, inflation is sticky, fiscal deficits, loss of credibility and Fed independence, all of these catalysts as to why yields are going to move higher from here at the precise time that if as everybody's on offsides on this trade, rates could start to rally, right? If we, I mean, even the geopolitical risk that we've been in the midst of currently in the Middle East, is that one catalyst? Is it earnings? Although earnings have been quite resilient, I think I'm glad you mentioned that, not to deviate here for a moment, but the pullback that we saw in equity prices over the last month actually provided a really attractive re-entry point if anyone did go to the sidelines with some of the risk that we saw, because earnings remained resilient and robust. And I think a lot of people were scratching their heads saying, like, valuations look pretty attractive. A lot of companies within like the tech sector went from like a 40 times multiple to a 20 without any adjustment in their underlying earnings and the fundamentals. So that to me is like a screaming buy signal. And I think that's part of the reason we saw this melt up in equities over the last, you know, 10 to 15 days. But kind of just getting back on track and thinking about the opportunities within, again, rates, I think there's a lot of catalysts that could lead us to see yields fall below that 4 year, or excuse me, that 4% mark. We've started to see cracks in employment, although a lot of people are saying that we no longer need these payroll reports of 100,000, 200,000 to sustain just because of reduced immigration. That's a whole different topic, of course. But we've been talking about a recession for 4 years now, and it's never really come about. And I think just again, at the precise moment that everybody's looking one direction, things might happen in the other. And so I say all this again is like the role of alternatives and diversification of portfolio alongside stocks and bonds it's just as important today as it was yesterday, as it will be tomorrow. But there's still a place for stocks and for bonds within a robust portfolio. So again, the importance of adding versus simply just removing and replacing.
On the correlation question, one interesting point that Alfonso Pecatiello brought up, which I thought really stuck in my mind, and it wasn't the first time, but you brought it up at a time when inflation suddenly spiked, and that was that as long as inflation is above 3%, that correlation between equities and bonds continues to.
I've heard it's as low as 2.5%. I mean, I haven't done the math myself.
Which is an even more challenging threshold.
Yeah, it's somewhere in that like, you know, high to upwards of 3% inflation figure that does result in like stock bond correlations being elevated or positive, at least historically. So it seems like we continue, even if inflation comes down for a couple months, it seems like the last few weeks and months we've seen that be stickier and kind of some upward pressure on that inflationary pressure, which leads all of us to then look at the stock bond correlation and say, like, I don't think that's going any lower anytime soon. So that, to your point, has been elevated, has been positive for several years now. And that's really the biggest pressure. I mean, not to oversimplify creating a portfolio, because I do it for a living, so I want to make it sound difficult so I can keep my job, of course. But stocks, bonds, you put them together. And for many advisors and their end clients, the bond component of the portfolio is there for income. And that's why I always say, like, what is the objective of your bonds? And it can have more than one objective. If it is simply income, bonds are kicking off some pretty attractive income right now.
But the question, Paisley, is it enough to offset the risk off periods? Because
I would even argue
it's not enough, right?
I agree.
It's not enough to offset.
I would argue that there are more innovative, higher distribution rate ways to achieve the income needs in the portfolio. And again, that's another podcast topic for another day. But exactly to your point, right? 2022 happened, and that was a rude awakening for so many people. And I think many people over the last, you know, 2023, 24, 25 even, because 2025 actually was a decent year for bond markets. Everybody's like, yeah, okay, it happened. It happens once in a blue moon. We've moved on. Yeah. Stock bonds are good again. And so, again, I'm never betting against markets. I'm a long-term bull when it comes to investing in stock market and bond markets. But what we saw in the first quarter of 2026 was another gentle reminder that when your stocks go down, are your bonds there for ballast? And I think it was another proof point that stocks and bonds both just kind of muddled along throughout the first quarter. And I would say, wrapping up, you know, many advisors are probably meeting with their clients right now, recapping the first quarter performance, positioning markets. And I can guarantee you the conversations that advisors with zero alternatives in their portfolio are having are much more difficult than the conversations that the advisors that can point to their statements and say, we had commodities, we had low correlated assets, we had trend following. And for many and clients, that might be a, what is trend following? Mm-hmm. What are these diversifiers? I'm not familiar with these. But at the end of the day, I think there's this warm and fuzzy feeling because they added really attractive positive return at a time when the rest of their portfolio was rolling over. And so again, how do you make your life easier as an advisor? How do you help your clients navigate these pockets of volatility?
Yeah.
And first quarter was a perfect example of that in practice.
What risks have they overlooked now in the midst of rising asset correlations and geopolitical tensions?
High level, I would say, despite the fact that we had 2022, like I said, I think there's been a bit of complacency. 2022 happened and it caught so many people off guard. And by the time that they woke up and realized what they could do about it, it was almost too late, or they felt like it was too late. And so I actually am not certain that enough advisors evolved their portfolio either throughout the drawdown in 2022 or immediately thereafter. And again, I think people just kind of put up their hands and said, like, it's a lost cause. We've moved on. It's fine. It's in the past. So if that's you and you're listening, does the first quarter of 2026 make you realize that maybe this type of market backdrop and this macro backdrop is here to stay? And so from my perspective, the biggest risk that from a portfolio construction standpoint, advisors are still facing in their portfolios is just not enough diversification. For the last decade of my career, I look at advisor portfolios every single week, and there is essentially minimal commodity exposure. And I think I can make sense of this. The last 10 years, commodities have been pretty flat. There's been some little bouts of vol here, like in 2015, 2016 with some oil markets and such. But the major commodity within most passive vehicles for commodity exposure, the major market is oil and gas. And literally up until a couple weeks ago, oil and gas have been extremely deflationary. We've had an oversupply glut here in the US. We've obviously picked up a lot of refining activity. We're kind of self-sustaining now. And so if you're looking at commodity indices and passive commodity expressions in ETFs or funds, you're underwhelmed. And even when we had the inflationary impacts in 2021 coming out of COVID, that was such a nuanced, unique part of inflationary markets that wasn't really driving oil and gas higher. And that's why you just didn't see a lot of these commodity allocations really deliver what investors historically thought. So bringing back to your question is, what is the biggest risk that portfolios face? Is it still a grossly underowned allocation to diversifiers? And then I think the question becomes, what are diversifiers, right? Because traditionally bonds were diversifiers. Are we talking about commodities? Are we talking about long, short equity? Are we talking about trend following? The answer is yes, yes, and yes. And I'll take it one step further because you brought up gold. That was really unique. I think gold has behaved outside of the normal confines for really the last 12 months. And it became a bit of a momentum trade in 2025. Foreign central banks had been piling into gold since 2022 with the Russia-Ukraine crisis. And ultimately, then retail investors started to pick up on that. And so then retail investors started to pile into gold halfway through 2025. So we had a lot of volatility in gold. It no longer was viewed as the safe haven asset. It was moving alongside equities, moving higher. And exactly to your point, which is very important, if you're just looking at the price of gold in the first quarter, you're kind of scratching your head out, you know, beyond January into February and March of why would gold sell off if we have this like geopolitical shock? And exactly to your point, it became a liquidity vehicle for many clients because it had so much embedded gains that when all else fails, what do you need to sell to meet redemptions, cash flow needs for your clients? It's the asset that has, you know, it's green. So, or it's in the black. So,
yeah.
The uniqueness of this goes back to broader commodities and alternatives as like a bigger picture. It's a very heterogeneous space. So when we talk about equities or equity beta, even if you're in international equities or US or small caps or large, like there's this beta profile that all of us have become familiar with, and bonds kind of likewise. When you get into the diversification bucket and you start talking about alternatives, there is so much dispersion or differentiated outcomes that as an allocator, right, it can be very overwhelming. And so this is why we go back to, like, you don't need to be paralyzed by all these options, like the analysis paralysis statement. And commodities is a great example of that. The price of gold, the price of oil, the price of cattle feeder, the price of, you know, white sugar, all of these various markets are so heterogeneous. The risk, the return, the impact, the supply, the demand, the weather patterns for many of these are what's driving this. And if you really think about it, if you're an allocator and you're looking for a truly unique source of risk and return to complement your traditional assets like stocks and bonds, you don't want to be directly tied to economic growth risk. You do not want to be directly tied to inflation risks. And so if you think about some of these markets, I'll give you a really unique example. Price of cocoa in 2024 was up 200-300%. Why is that? It's because they had extreme droughts in West Africa, which produces 60% of the cocoa population, or cocoa supply.
Yeah.
And so that's a really unique, I mean, we're kind of laughing about this, but like that's a very unique source of risk and return. That's not tied to global equity markets. That's not tied to inflation. And so I use that as an extreme example to say there's so many opportunities out there to introduce these really unique drivers of risk and return in the portfolio. Pinpointing which of these is going to be additive at any point in time is a fool's errand, which goes back to then how do you think about accessing, say, commodities? Many advisors historically have a standalone gold allocation in their portfolio and maybe some tips. And right, like that's their diversifier. Well, what we found out in the last couple of years is, guess what, guys? Your tips generally have interest rate risk within them as well. Unless you were in short duration tips, you picked up interest rate or duration risk when you were meaning to fight against that very risk, which was inflation, which is harmful for bonds.
And it's so offsetting.
So many advisors were shocked of like, I bought tips and inflation went up. Why are my tips in the red? Ultimately, it's because you had duration risk. So there's little nuances there. But again, commodities, if you just held gold, you've had a wild ride over the last year. It's hopefully been additive. Gold is higher, but it has been a very high volatile asset. So how can you diversify that? How can you look at accessing diversification within commodities by going into a more kind of broader subset of markets and one that's dynamic? And this goes back to my earlier comment. Oil and gas have been extremely deflationary over the last decade or so. And so if you're in just a passive commodity index type fund, oil and gas have been anywhere from 25 to 35% of that allocation. Whereas going into an active commodity strategy, one that is dynamic and flexible and can adjust and adapt its positioning, you're way better off and way more agile to navigate what is obviously becoming an increasingly volatile market.
Paisley, like in your view, why do so few of us and so few advisor portfolios allocate meaningfully to strategies like managed futures, despite their proven crisis alpha?
Yeah, I think that's what's wild to me. We've now had several proof points in like the post-COVID era where trend following has been so additive. I think typically what happens is it's more of a psychology behavioral issue, I think, than an actual investment result. And let me just give you some examples. Investors understand stocks and bonds. They watch CNBC, they see it on the news, and it's easy to follow for some, of course. When it comes to alternatives, understanding what they are, how they behave, when they behave, and why they're deviating, that's a lot of educational gap. Right. And so as an advisor and an allocator, it becomes really easy to say, you know what, I can see there's these pockets of opportunity where having these alternatives and managed futures in particular have been beneficial. It's just not worth the headache. I don't want to have to explain to my clients what they are, how they work, when they work, when they don't work. But ultimately, if we can help close the behavioral educational gap by showcasing that by having these alternative sources of risk in the portfolio, it doesn't mean that you need to sacrifice return. Because at the end of the day, and I don't mean to oversimplify or make people sound naive as investors, we are all human though. If you don't understand something in your portfolio line item statement and it has a negative return, the chances of you wanting to scrutinize, dive in, dissect that fund or that strategy are probably higher than if you look at your line item and something has an awesome return and you don't fully understand it.
Yeah.
You might ask a couple questions, but you're like, hey, it's doing it. It's awesome. Love it. Let's keep it. And so like that kind of the dissonance, I would say, from a behavioral perspective, is I think what continues to prevent many investors from allocating to the space, despite the fact that it has shown its ability to not only offer very attractive diversification, many trend strategies have a negative correlation to equities. Well, let's just start there. We're not talking low average correlation. We are talking, in many instances, negative correlation. And then this, I would say, historical belief that, okay, great, you got your diversification, but it's done nothing for portfolio return. Because that was really the case in the post-GFC era. We had no volatility in the markets. Rates were zero. Many of these alternative strategies, which have a lot of cash as collateral because they're utilizing derivatives, were just earning nothing. And so people kind of like, yeah, doesn't work, didn't work, move on. Over the last 5 or so years, many trend following strategies, and there is high dispersion, so look at, you know, different managers, different investment processes, but many of these strategies have kept up with traditional stock bond portfolios, if not outperformed them. And here's like a fascinating stat that I pulled this up like 10 times because I was like, I must be doing the math wrong. But over the last trailing 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and 25 years, so trailing period across all of those, if you look at managed futures at just the index level, I'm not talking about some of the higher octane, really attractive alpha strategies, just
like the benchmark.
Yeah, the benchmark.
SocGen.
Yep. Yeah. SocGen CTA index. If you look at that versus the ag, like the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index, which used to be the Bloomberg Barclays, which used to be the Barclays Lehman, which used to be the Lehman Ag Index, but trend following has outperformed bonds in all of those periods. And I don't want to like...
Amazing. I mean, it's amazing when you look at it, you know, over the long term and even over, you know, shorter rolling periods.
So when we're talking about not removing or replacing your bonds, but diversifying your bonds into a strategy like managed futures that has consistently delivered low to no correlation to stocks and bonds. So like a true ballast, a true diversifier, and is also outperform bonds on a total return perspective. What are we talking about here? This is so easy from my perspective, but it goes back to that behavioral consideration of, when you have a period where equities melt up and equities are doing exceptionally well, and then your client points to that one line item, let's just say it is managed futures for the quarter, why was the return flat when equities were up 6%? And so as an advisor, you understand it just because, but if you can really share some of these profound, impactful historical data points of outperformance versus bond, consistently low correlated, saving your portfolio in a period like the first quarter of 2026 or the entire calendar year for the most part of 2022, just smoothing that ride is what these diversifiers are doing. Like I think you can start to close some of that behavioral educational gap. And that's ultimately what's going to drive a lot of attention to the space. And then one thing we were talking about even before we hit record today is the likes of like the major asset management companies who all have launched managed futures ETFs in the last 12 months, and they've all added them to their strategic model portfolio allocations.
Yeah.
And so this is now going to be a bit of a ripple effect where over the next couple of years, we're going to become more familiar with seeing trend following managed futures in our standard model portfolios, and we're going to just get more comfortable over time in that respect as well.
You know, I became familiar with CTAs about 5 years ago. And And at that moment, I knew virtually nothing about it, right? So even after having been an advisor for 15 years, a wholesaler to advisors for 5 years, and this for the last 16, 17 years, even after all that time around the business, and I think that applies to anybody, that you could, you know, there's so much specialization in this industry. So the first time I heard about it, I knew nothing about it. It sounded very complicated. And then I reached a point maybe about a year after, you know, I had been introduced to the topic of CTAs, where I sort of had this light bulb moment. And it was during a podcast. And I said, you know, I don't understand why, you know, this is exactly what people expect from their advisors. This is what people grew up expecting from their PMs, their advisors, whoever was managing their money, which was that, you know, when the market's down, you're out of stocks. When the market's up, you're back in stocks. You know, you're all this timing stuff, right? Was the perception that people had of portfolio managers. That's what they do anyway. Mm-hmm. So that was a light bulb moment for me. And I sort of blurted it out, you know, isn't this what people always expected? And then, you know, when you get through that, then the question I had was, you know, how hard is it to explain to a layperson, to an average investor? And then when you start talking about futures and trading and signals and trend following and commodities, does it all start to sound like the trading pits, right?
Yeah,
Is it Randolph and Mortimer?
Right? I created an educational presentation, not strategy specific in any regard, but just what are managed futures? Because to your point, I think people hear that and they're like, oh, wow, black box, I'm overwhelmed. And it's less about the investment process and the signals and the indicators and the time horizons. And it's more about what are the outcomes? Let's start there, mm-hmm. right? You're actually getting true, consistent diversification. It's zigging when the rest of the portfolio is zagging, and it's giving you positive return. For many people, like, okay, I'm in. For many other people, though, they're like, okay, great, but what is this? How does this work? Why does this work? And then
That's the hard part. Like, you could get advisors on side, but then they're thinking, the advisor, the allocator's thinking, how do I get my clients on side?
And that's where I go back to, it starts, the beauty of many of these markets is like, this is actually quite tangible. And I always use commodities as the reference point, because many of trend following managed future strategies, commodities are a meaningful component of them. But you go back to the 70s, and you had commodity producers, whether it was ranchers, you know, buying and selling cattle, it was, you know, farmers buying and selling their harvest, their crop. And then you start to think about, like, in order to run a business, you need consistency within your revenue stream and the costs that you're bearing. And so the way that a lot of this futures trading came about was to help smooth the business perspective for many of these farmers and ranchers and, you know, producers.
Right.
And they were able to then hedge, right? So we know that we're going to have X production at the end of this quarter. Let's hedge the price so that we don't have a lot of variability, so we can manage our own business. And I feel like when you start to tell the story of like how futures trading came about, especially within the commodity markets, I think any layman can start to understand and digest that.
Right.
And then you extrapolate that of like, okay, great. So they were doing this purely for a business sense, and then it became profitable. And that's how then this, as more of an investment strategy, came about, is you could start to profit. And by profiting as an investment practitioner and investing in futures, buying and selling, you're actually providing a ton of liquidity for the people that actually need it for hedging their business purposes. And so it's this like bigger cycle that I just start, I feel like that provides a little bit more of that tangibility, or it's just a little bit more digestible, where it's like, okay, this started from like a very innocent, good place of just small businesses being able to run their businesses in a more smooth fashion, to like now we've extrapolated this into a way to actually profit and hedge broader portfolios. So although that's a bit of a stretch, but it is also very true, and kind of starting from that standpoint is like, starts to feel a little bit more easy to incorporate within a portfolio in case your end clients are inquiring.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when the stories of speculative triumphs or failures in futures markets that has thrown that perception curveball. Because when you actually get down to why these markets exist, they exist in order to help stabilize the market.
Yep.
That's true for the options market. That's true for the futures market. All of these derivatives were designed in the first place to provide hedging.
Yep.
And then you get into the word hedging, and people hear hedge funds and they think, again, they reflect on the speculative highlights of hedging that people hear about that make the news. And then they think, oh, that's way too sophisticated for me to know or to understand or to explain. And again, hedge funds were created to help wealthy investors and institutions preserve the wealth, not risk it.
Yep.
Not take more risk, but to reduce risk that is out there in the wild, right? In the wild of the equity market and bond market. The thing that's ironic is that most investors today, most retail investors are out in the wild.
I was going to say, what's scarier to me is triple levered NVIDIA, but we won't go there.
Right. But investors are out in the wild. If you just own a basic, an equity portfolio and some bonds, a 60-40 portfolio, you're actually out in the wild because there's no hedging in either of those. One is supposed to hedge the other, and that's not working anymore the way it did for the last 40 years, mostly. Mm-hmm. So as a retail investor without any diversification in the sense that we're talking about, not by label, but by risk weighting in a portfolio, you may be doing nothing to actually offset your risk.
Typically, when we've spoken about diversification or hedge fund-like strategies, as an investor, you assume I'm giving up I'm paying higher fees in order to get this. So that's already a drag, which 100% agree. If you were paying high fees, whether it be just a management fee or kind of performance fee, carry fee, whatever it may be, higher fees are a huge headwind for performance. So that's a concern. And then the other concern is liquidity. Okay, now I'm investing in something. I don't know when I can access my capital. And so I just want to be very clear that when we talk about our discussion here today is really centered around liquid alternatives, meaning daily liquid. They're in ETFs, right. They're in mutual funds. Many of these have no K-1s for tax consequences. And so we're really talking about no different from an investment experience of investing in, a passive equity ETF or bond ETF or these, right? Daily liquid. Right. And as a result of the innovation and the proliferation of many of these large asset managers bringing these strategies to market, broadly across the industry, we've seen this race to the bottom from a fee perspective. That's also pressuring fees lower in alternatives. So if you're familiar or used to seeing, 1.5-2% on some of these alt funds from a fee perspective, like take a look again. We're talking as low as 30, 40, 50 basis points for some of these daily liquid. And so I feel like that becomes easier then for many to wrap their head around is like, okay, I can see how I can fit this within a broader portfolio. Because alternatives have absolutely seen so much innovation over the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. So you've got first of all, which we've been talking about is risk budgeting. But now we've got fee budgeting. And if you own beta ETFs that cost next to nothing to own, then you do have room in your fee budget to incorporate some ETFs like CTA that have a slightly higher cost in order to incorporate diversifiers, like something a little more sophisticated and something with a little more skill too, that actually does cost money to own, but not much more. So when you have a blended, when you can build a portfolio that incorporates the diversifiers, like the other thing is that 5 years ago, this wasn't possible.
No.
as recently as 5 years ago. I mean, we're talking in 1 year after COVID.
You know? Absolutely. But that's why I
before
say
before that, it was only institutions, you know, and ultra high net worth investors who could, you know, get involved and participate in these types of diversifiers. Now, everybody can.
Yeah, I would say it's very much still a nascent, meaning small but growing part of the market. And I, like I said, I think a lot of people, 2022 came and went, and they feel like, I've missed it. First quarter 2026 came and went, and like, I missed it again. Like, whatever, it's no big deal. We are just really, like I said, on this cusp of this becoming a broader standard part of a balanced portfolio. And again, this goes back to where we started the conversation. The stock bond portfolio worked exceptionally well over the last roughly 40 years. And so we're not saying that was oversimplified from a construction perspective and that was stupid or silly or naive. Like, it worked. But rather than just keep your head down and assume it's going to continue to work, there's plenty of reasons why we've discussed higher bond yields, reduction in stock bond correlation, a shift in the macro regime from a political standpoint, supply-demand imbalances, this real asset infrastructure build-out that we're talking about, and it's not just related to AI. I think globally, even in Germany last year, we saw a huge fiscal bill for government spending as well. And so we're just really at this cusp of like a changing of the regime and changing of the guards. And so just because a 60-40 stock bond portfolio worked for the last 40 years doesn't mean it's going to work for the next 40. And so it's not so much like throwing out stocks and bonds. It's saying, let's keep them. And I always use this analogy of like, let's think about this as a stool. And you have two legs to the stool. One is stocks, one is bonds. It's probably going to be a pretty unstable stool. If we can add a third leg to that stool, which would be diversifiers, alternatives, we can build the resiliency of that portfolio, meaning we can make this stool far more stable to sit upon. And again, this is not throwing everything out the window. It's improving, it's enhancing. And oftentimes the question then becomes like, okay, great, Paisley, love it. I'm buying in. However, where do I start? Am I doing 5%? Am I doing 10%? Am I doing 40%? There's no right answer, but we typically see a lot of advisors starting with around a 10% allocation to this alternative. Many of them are sourcing it directly from bonds for all the reasons we've already mentioned.
Right.
Others are saying, you know what, I'm going to play it safe here, pull half from bonds, half from stocks. But anything less than 10% at the total portfolio level is probably not going to be enough to move the needle when we have a, you know, a period like the first quarter of this year, 2022. But it's at least a step in the right direction.
You've got an interesting take on the CTA. Now, I know we didn't get into the mechanics of it, you know, except broadly. But in your ETF strategy that you've had running for roughly 4 years now, you've got one thing that's really interesting, which is that you've deliberately excluded equity and FX from your CTA strategy.
We have.
Paisley, if you can explain why.
Yeah, so this is a polarizing topic. Some of our investors, the reason that they've chosen to invest with us in our CTA ETF, which by the way, shout out to Simplify for reserving that ticker, because we talk about CTAs at the industry, which is commodity trading advisors, but we also, we reserve the ticker CTA for our strategy. Yeah. So I know it can be a little confusing. Again, very polarizing in the sense that equities tend to move higher over time. And if you have equities within a trend following portfolio, that means you can ride the wave higher, right? When equities melt up, you can pile into equities, you can be long equities, and you can reap greater upside return. And that's exactly, I'll give you, you know, just 2025. Many of our peers that had equities in their remit for their trend following strategy piled into equities after the tariff tantrum. And as a result, they outperformed us in 2025. Is that right? Is that wrong? Is that bad? Is that good? Depends on what your objective is. If your objective by investing in trend following is to maximize return, equities can be quite additive over time. If your objective is to truly just be a capital efficient source of diversification for your portfolio, removing equities ensures that even in periods when equities are moving higher, you're going to still be that ballast. You're going to be that diversification. And so that was really the construction decision that we intentionally made when we launched CTA back in 2022, was that we understood investors would be using this as ballast, as a bond replacement for the most part.
Right.
And so how do we remove as much equity beta from the mandate as possible? And that ultimately led us to remove equity and FX, or foreign exchange currencies, from the mandate. More specifically, as it relates to currencies, ultimately what happens is you kind of pile into more of the higher beta, higher growth oriented emerging market equities. And so when you do have these economic crashes, those tend to roll over harder than the other. And so it just resulted in a lot of additional beta and drawdown that we weren't looking to provide our investors. So it is a trade-off. We always say, you know, if we have equities, we could probably produce some higher alpha, but we're also category leading with a Morningstar 5-star rating. So I think we're doing just fine even without them.
I think it's an interesting trade-off. I think it's a really interesting choice because it brings your narrative and your thesis closer to that zero beta.
Yeah, and that's too, going back to the funding question we talked about, which is why typically our investors will source an allocation to CTA from the bonds. It's because we don't have the equity beta within our strategy.
In your updates and your podcast, your recent podcast, you had some really great charts that you shared that actually demonstrated the value of having CTAs in the portfolio. I mean, when the two lines were superimposed, you could actually very clearly see the diversification benefit, the inverse diversification benefit that the CTA ETF and its strategy was providing to a 60-40 portfolio. So I thought that was remarkable.
Yeah, it's powerful when you see the actual return pattern. Again, the key objective here, if I'm diversifying away from stocks and bonds, I really need to ensure that it's going to matter. Is it really providing me that diversification benefit? And if you look at a historical performance chart where you map CTA since its 2022 inception alongside a 60-40 portfolio, it is almost a mirror image, which is what Pierre is describing here, of like the zig and the zag pattern is like when your 60-40 sells off, CTA goes up and vice versa. And I think it's such a powerful visual. It's my favorite chart. Because it's a mic drop moment in my perspective. Is like, you're telling me that you're providing the diversification, but show me in practice that that's exactly what you're delivering. And that chart is a wonderful proof point.
As a second responder in a portfolio, it actually does what you say it does, which is I thought was remarkable.
The other benefit that I try to be humble about, but I don't need to be in this instance, I guess, is at the end of the day, you're getting that zigzag pattern. But also, too, when the CTA strategy is pretty consistently outperforming the 60-40 portfolio.
Right.
Again, it kind of speaks to that. And that's why we've actually coined the strategy as a hedge that you get paid to own. Because going back to, again, behavioral, at least through history, behavior will tell us that, okay, great, I'm hedging my portfolio, but it means I'm sacrificing something. And so like the ability to give you that hedge, but also give you attractive return more so than a 60-40 has provided, very powerful.
How are you positioning multi-asset portfolios at your end to capture the potential commodity super cycle?
Yeah, so we live and breathe alternatives on a daily basis. I think we've very much been under the belief for the last few years that we are in this kind of changing of the guards, changing regime backdrop from a macro perspective. And as you highlighted, whether it's a commodity super cycle or a diversifier cycle more broadly, the importance of having some of these non-traditional sources of risk and return, i.e. anything beyond kind of traditional stocks and bonds, is so important and is so necessary. It's not a nice to have, it's a need to have over the next decade. And so as it relates to positioning within our multi-asset portfolios, we tend to have greater allocation to alternatives. So if we're thinking about a conservative or a balanced type portfolio where you have, you know, your 40-60 or your 60-40 type allocation, rather than having that bond allocation be the majority of it, we tend to see a higher allocation to alternatives. And oftentimes that can mean if, you know, within your non-equity part of the portfolio, half is bonds, half is alternatives. And then within the alternatives allocation more broadly, We have a representation of having dynamic commodity allocations. We have a representation of being in the trend following space. We even have more of some unique alternatives and diversifiers, which is a long short currency strategy, which is, we have a little over a year track record on the strategy now. It has about a 9% distribution rate, and it's outperformed the S&P 500 with a low correlation. So you start to look at how all of these play together within a portfolio and really providing, again, that attractive return potential, diversifying away from bonds. And then sometimes, too, I think investors forget that some of these alternatives have really attractive yield profiles. I just mentioned our currency strategy. That's more than double the distribution rate of a core bond fund. Even our CTA strategy, we kick off some pretty attractive income. It's around 4 to 5% annualized distribution rate. And so if you are funding these allocations from bonds, it doesn't mean you have to sacrifice on that income need as well, but you're getting stronger ballast in the portfolio alongside equities.
Would you say, like, if for an advisor, you know, advisors obviously are on board with wanting to build resilient models, resilient model portfolios for their clients. And so there's the education on ramp. If they haven't already brought themselves up to speed on these alternatives, these liquid alternatives and diversifiers, their diversification benefits. Is it pretty safe to say that if an advisor looked at like some of your core multi-asset offerings, that they could get a pretty good idea of what the allocation mix looks
on
like?
On our website, we have all of our model portfolios on our website at simplify.us, where you can find how we allocate across different risk parameters, like you said, whether it's conservative, moderate, growth. We also have standalone kind of completion model portfolios that are an income focus or an alternative focus. Because typically, I mean, a big part of the value add that advisors bring to their clients is some of the portfolio construction, maybe even some security selection, manager due diligence. And so we're aware that, you know, it's not always like a one size fits all. And so if we can just provide where we truly add value, which is in the higher income and the more diversifying strategies, they can get an idea of what those look like on a standalone and kind of plug those on or bolt those on to some of their existing model portfolios. And I think that's helpful because this doesn't have to be like, whatever you're doing, throw it out the window, listen to us. It's more like whatever you're doing is probably working and you're just looking to refine it. You're looking to enhance it. You're looking to be proactive by making some small portfolio changes. And so having more of these bolt-on target objectives makes it easier to do.
I think advisors appreciate very much what you're doing, first of all, but I think you have great resources for advisors available on your site. Where can advisors, I mean, who don't already know about Simplify Asset Management, where could they find you?
Yeah, so our website is simplify.us. We have social media presence on X as well as LinkedIn. We have a YouTube channel that you will find all of our current and historical videos. We do some podcasts. We do relevant updates when central banks will meet just to talk about the movement of rates. We have monthly videos that talk to some of our strategies like CTA to provide just a little bit more transparency as to positioning portfolio returns as well as market performance. And so all of those are resources. Our website houses almost all of this as well. We also have quite a few research papers, blog posts, and insights. So all of that is available at simplify.us. And we are very accessible. So would love to field any questions. Please reach out to us directly and happy to support.
And Paisley, you've got a great podcast as well that you've...
Yeah, thank you. I started a personal podcast about a year ago, which the title of it is called Building Better Portfolios. Right. And I do it with my co-host, Josh Flade, who is a past president of the CFA Society in Salt Lake City. And we bring on a lot of guests across various asset classes to really just think about how can you improve your portfolio, be thoughtful about adding unique sources of risk and return. And we get to pick the minds of a lot of really brilliant people and share that with our listeners. So thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah, it's great. All this and more at simplify.us and building better portfolios with Paisley. Last question, Paisley, what do you think What do you think is the biggest surprise 12 months from now?
I think the biggest surprise 12 months from now will be movement and rates. I think people are underestimating that rates are going to stay higher for longer. And so if I had a crystal ball and I had to make a guess or throw a dart, I would say that, because as of right now, markets have repriced rate expectations. We started with 2 to 3 rate cuts for 2026 and into 2027, and all of that has been wiped off. And so they now have this blank canvas where I think it's not to say that markets are going to fall off a cliff over the next few months, but I think we'll be back on track with rates heading lower 12 months from now. And I think that that is a risk that a lot of people are not accounting for in their portfolios.
Paisley, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been great catching up with you. I hope we can do it more often.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. And we'll at least have to have me back in 12 months so we can either laugh at my silly crystal ball assumption, or we can say, hey, look, we're here. But thank you for having me, and always happy to share insights and have a great conversation.